Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Life Without Limits podcast. I am your host, Yogi Roth, and I'm loving this. We have really talked about a variety of different things thus far. You know, it's kind of funny. I keep hearing from people about the very first one where my mom came on. She was so honest to learn that story. It was epic. And we've kind of just gone on a variety of different paths, from street artists to inspirational speakers to former professional athletes who've taken the road less traveled. And today, I'm pumped, man. This is, you know, as I've said many times on this podcast, I kind of see my life through a podcast now. Everyone I meet, I want to bring them on. I want to have these meaningful conversations about people charging. And today's guest is a guy named Tyler Palko. And if you follow football at all, you'll definitely know the name. He was Mr. Everything in high school. We'll get into that. He went to the University of Pittsburgh, where he was my teammate, actually hosted him on his visit when he was a young pup. And away his career went. It was kind of up and down, but he has this perseverance that we're going to talk about. I'm really stoked to talk to him about competing, because when he finished his college career, he went and competed at the highest of levels in the sport, in the NFL, and always kind of had adversity come through his life, but found a way to see the positive. So we're going to talk about the unique elements of competing, the dark side of competing, and how he's pushed through it, and really now how he's inspiring the next generation of leaders. So it'll be funny. It'll be weird. This is a guy I haven't talked to in a while, so this is as much of a catch-up session as it is an interview. So let's not waste any more time and bring my man, Tyler Palko, in. Tyler, you there?
Yo, I'm here, buddy.
Oh, I love it. It's been way too long since we've chatted. How have you been?
I'm good, man. Thank God for technology. At least we can stay connected through text, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and all those things, man. But I really think that, you know, it's really true that, you know, what our parents tell you about those relationships you build through college do truly last a lifetime. And no matter if it's been, you know, 2 years, 2 months, or 2 days, you know, you really feel that, you know, talking to you right now, like I just left you yesterday. So it's been I'm really excited, looking forward to it, being on here with you.
I think that's a really interesting jumping off point because, you know, we both have siblings, younger siblings. And I still look at, like, my younger brother like he's 13, you know? And there's an element of me when I look at you of a guy who I've seen grow since you were – God, I think I met you when you were, like, 14 years old, man. So I'd love to know, because that's how I view you. What's your perspective of even how you and I met each other? Because I think it's good to give the audience a general baseline of the relationship.
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, I mean, I grew up in Pittsburgh and obviously, you know, was very fortunate to have, you know, an early jumpstart to the recruiting process, had some success, whether it was luck or whatever, early in my high school career and started the recruiting process early and was always around Pitt, you know, at an early age, you know, my freshman year, I got offered by them. So I was always around the Pitt program and I think that a lot of the stuff that you talk about, and we've talked about, that you're naturally drawn toward people that you almost see yourself as, right? So you're drawn toward people that you almost look at, like when you look at a mirror, you see yourself. And I think that, you know, not blowing any smoke, but you know, when we met, at Pitt, I mean, you know, I saw, you know, a lot of me in you, and we were naturally drawn toward each other. We were grinders. We were guys that loved ball and wanted to compete. And I think that, you know, I remember standing on the sideline at practice, you know, number 82 came over and said, "Hey man, how you doing?" And I think that really started our relationship. You know, I don't think we both really knew too much about each other, but, it started then and pretty organic and it's taken off from there.
I love it. So, all right. What I love about Pennsylvania, as you do as well, is the high school football. And we're not going to get in the debate because there isn't one. We know that the East Coast football in Pennsylvania is much better than the West Coast. I grew up, for everyone listening, in the Scranton area, northeastern Pennsylvania. Tyler grew up in western Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh. But can you paint a picture for people what it was like for you to grow up? I mean, your dad was a coach. We're going to talk about that. But in high school, like, what was that like for you, for somebody that – has only seen varsity blues?
Well, I mean, I hate to use cliches, but and getting into, you know, using the word religion, but I mean, in all intents and purposes, it was a religion, right? I mean, if you wanted to rob a bank, you did it on Friday night. I mean, in Western Pennsylvania, I mean, literally everybody was there. I mean, you know, all week, whether you worked in the steel mill or whether you worked at, you know, a hardware store or a bank or whatever it was. I mean, you were at the game, your local game on Friday night, cheering on the team, and you would talk about when you played in 1953 and, you know, when you beat, you know, your rival high school on a game-winning field goal. And, I mean, everybody just bought into that high school program, and it was, you know, they lived vicariously through that. And I think that, you know, obviously there's a lot of good and bad to all of that, but, you know, we want to focus on the positive. It was literally, you know, fall in Western Pennsylvania, or Pennsylvania in general. It was all about ball. And, it was just something that you grew up and, you know, I wore number 3 in high school because of, you know, the kid who played quarterback when I was in 6th grade. So that, I mean, those types of things are, you know, that's the religion in it. I mean, it was what you lived for. Friday nights, the smell of the grass, the cracking of the pads, the band, the clicking of the cleats on the sidewalk. It was, you know, that was, I mean, I get goosebumps talking about it right now.
Yeah, you nailed it. And for you had a really unique experience, and we will share on the blog post about this conversation about a letter that you wrote to people about a conversation you had with your father. And your dad is a legendary high school coach in Pennsylvania. All that program has done in West Allegheny has won. Specifically about this experience where that you described with your father, can you describe that for our listeners who have not read the letter yet?
Yeah, I mean, so try to give a 30,000 foot view of it. I did grow up in a football family. My dad, you know, high school football coach and college coach, and took over a high school football program that was down in the dumps for a long time. And I was always around football. I mean, probably today, my dad would have gotten, you know, a letter in the mail because I was, you know, around the program probably at, you know, as soon as I could crawl or walk. I mean, I was in locker rooms and, you know, in the coach. But I mean, it wasn't anything that was institutionalized. I wanted to be around my dad, and he wanted me around. So I took there was a love there, a love affair that I started with football, and it was because of my dad and what he taught kids. You know, it really wasn't about football. It was about, and again, I know that's a cliche, but it was about life lessons. You know, you're going to have an opportunity to go to college and get it paid for. You're there to play football. That's rule number one. And he was honest with me. I mean, you're there to play football, but I expect you to take advantage of your education and the experience there, and to earn a degree and to be ready for life after football. And then when football ended from college and I had an opportunity to play in the NFL, he shared with me, hey, you know, I love you. You know, you're going to have an opportunity to play in the NFL and live your childhood dream, but it's going to end at some point, and percentages say that you're not going to have a say-so when it ends, and you better be ready for life after football. And it wasn't that I needed to be scared of it ending, but it was, I needed to be ready when it did, to, you know, get on, as Chuck Noll would say, with your life's work. And those lessons were taught, you know, when I was 2 and 3, 4 years old, seeing how he was there for his players. And, you know, he really had a vested interest in whether they succeeded as a person or not. And again, I know that's a cliche, but today, I mean, his players are, you know, 45, 50 years old and still come back and still talk to him about the time that he gave them that advice. And I mean, I was just lucky enough for him to be my father. So it was, again, it was one of those goosebump moments, but very fortunate to have a guy like that in my life.
What's your first memory of competing?
you know, there's so many of them, because every little thing that my dad and I did, and then obviously my brother, he's 16 months younger than me. He played receiver for us and for me when I played quarterback, had an opportunity to play in college at St. Francis, and now is in the front office for the Arizona Cardinals in the NFL. Everything was a competition. I mean, it was roll up a piece of foil after dinner and see who could throw it in the garbage can or the laundry basket, or, you know, see who could get up the stairs the fastest to go to bed. I mean, everything was a competition. And it was, I mean, from honestly, the moment that I can remember as far back, it was always something that we competed. And I, to this day, I don't remember any one moment that we don't compete. I mean, my brother was always smarter than me, and we would compare literally math tests. So it was a competitive household, and I have a sister that played Division I sports too. So, I mean, from the moment that I can remember as far back, and I've been hitting ahead a bunch, but it was always about competing, and it was a cool environment to grow up in.
So how do you think back then would you define what competing meant, and then how would you define it now? And are they different?
Well, competing, I guess the biggest being able to look back on it, competing now, I mean, it's what life is about, you know. And I think the problem that I don't want to get into being philosophical on problems, but the problem is that we try to institutionalize everything. Right. So we try to take something as organic and is so beautiful as competition, and we try to institutionalize it. Competing is what you do, whether you're playing the piano or, you know, playing an athletic event or, you know, trying to compete to win a spelling bee. I mean, it's all about competing to win, to be the best. I mean, it's that inner struggle of how can you compete against yourself and then, you know, try to compete against, you know, others that are involved in it. I think that it's such a beautiful thing, competition. And competing, what it taught me is that winning is hard at anything, at any level. And to do it at a really, really high level and to do it for a long period of time, those people that have done it, I mean, it's hard. And there's a lot of adversity that comes along with it, dealing with all the things that it takes to stay at the top of your industry, your craft. And that's the takeaway, you know, being 32 now, that I look back on, that I think that's not really talked about a lot, is winning is just, it's hard, and competition is a beautiful thing, but it's something that it's hard to win. And that, I think that's the biggest takeaway that I've, you know, like I said, being 32, that I've really fallen back on.
It's neat. You know, if you look at your iPhone, you know, if somebody's looking at this right now and they look up the word compete, it would say to strive against one another, against something. But if you look at the Latin root of the word, or the origin, it's to strive together. And to me, I feel like this is a word that over time has totally shifted. So it's about me kicking your ass, right? About me beating you out. And really, I think as we get older, we realize that competition, as you just referenced, is about maximizing your potential. And you know what, Tyler, you're going to make me better. I'm going to make you better. And we can still try to get after it. I'm still going to take you to the rack and vice versa. But the focus isn't on the outcome of me beating you. It's more of the outcome of me beating me. And I'm curious about you and your career, because I wonder how you would describe your mindset when you were an athlete, specifically in college when we were around each other, because I can remember you working your craft when no one was looking. You were the definition of the lonely work, right? Like, you were competing against yourself to be great, but there's this other side of like, I got to go beat this guy out. I have to take his spot. Did you struggle between those two definitions of the same word? And do you even agree with those two definitions?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with, you know, what you said. I mean, you know as well as I do, right? I mean, you know, there's, when you're young, you know, you tend to look at things different than you do, you know, when you have some wisdom and experience in life, right? I mean, and I think, you know, the fact, just because you work hard doesn't necessarily guarantee you anything in life, right? And I think when you're in that position as a young guy, and we're trying to put those hours in, and you want to be a grinder, and you just want to, you know, I remember my dad telling me, hey, just keep chopping wood. And I would look at him like, I mean, what are you talking about? Keep chopping wood. I mean, like I'm trying to win a starting quarterback job chopping wood. Like, but it was a metaphor. And I make light of it, but, I think that's, I mean, there's no real one blanket answer for competition. You know, there's obviously different definitions and, you know, I think everybody has something, whatever that is, that's motivating them to, you know, to be great, right? You know, do they want to earn a scholarship? Do they want to play in the NFL? Do they want to, you know, win the Nobel Peace Prize? Whatever that is that motivates you, I think that really kind of frames the idea of what they're competing against. You pose, as you always have with me, some thought-provoking questions, and I really don't know how to do that in a short amount of time. If you ask it again, I could probably answer it a little bit better. But from what I remember the question being, I just think that the competition in what you and I remember it as when we were in college, I mean, it was about how do I create that edge for myself. Now, that edge may not guarantee me a starting position, but I know when I go in to compete for that job that I have that edge, right? And that edge is going to help me, whether it's immediate or whether it's, you know, prolonged, it's going to help me. And I think that's something that I learned through those lonely nights of competition or early mornings where you just found your edge. And you knew when you went in to compete, you had it. And that gave you that sense of confidence to go compete. I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Well, you know, it's great. I mean, I think it's a great segue to look back in time for a minute of, you know, you were a high school quarterback and, you know, you're USA Today All-American, you know. And I was that kid who every time the USA Today All-American team came out every year, it'd be up on my wall in my bedroom, you know, as a kid, you know, and you'd be striving to get on that. You're there. You've got scholarship offers from USC to everyone in the SEC, all across the country, and you chose to go to Pitt. You know, no offense to our alma mater, we weren't winning national championships, let alone getting to major bowl games when you made that decision. One, what was that pressure like for you, if there was pressure? And two, why did you choose to go to Pitt knowing that you're such a great competitor and knowing that if you looked around the country, other teams were competing at higher levels per se. If you just looked at it from an objective standpoint, they're winning bowl games, going to BCS games, and we weren't, we were kind of top third of the Big East at the time.
That's a great question. I have a different perspective on that. Just simply because I've always viewed myself as, you know, and I'm sure you've heard people, you know, talking about they never feel that they're good enough or, you know, they really want to, you know, make an impact or whatever drives them. And I'm from Pittsburgh. I'm a blue collar guy. Parents, they both worked jobs. My dad, you know, he worked four jobs when we were younger. I mean, did whatever he had to do to, you know, to put food on the table. And, you know, there was just this love affair with Pittsburgh, and I can't tell you why, but I specifically remember going through this process and knowing, you know, I could go to these, you know, more prominent schools and be there, and they were rolling the red carpet out. They were, you know, we have better facilities and all of these things, but there was just something about the opportunity to turn something around, to be part of something from the ground up, to be able to do something with your hometown where you grew up, where everybody, you know, values that sport. And you knew that they were great, you know, the Dan Marino era. You knew that you wanted to, or at least me, I wanted to be able to be a part of bringing that back. And that's probably why. I mean, I remember when I committed to Pitt, I woke up one morning. I was at the Pitt quarterback receiver camp, was rooming with Larry at time, and I woke up one morning and I just had this like I don't know whatever epiphany or what, and I said I called my mom and dad. I said, this is where I want to go. And my dad asked me why. And I couldn't tell him. I woke up and I had this, that I just wanted to make an impact. I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to turn it around. I wanted to bring and restore the tradition that I grew up around. And, there's no real cool answer about that other than I wanted to be part of building something. I wanted to be able to be the underdog and to prove people wrong. And that's, I wanted to do that at Pitt.
There's a lot of young quarterbacks that are going to be listening to this that have 40 plus offers to major colleges, and they're the dudes, and the red carpet's getting rolled out, and they are going to things like the Elite 11, like you went to. What's your advice to them, and what was the Elite 11 experience like for you? Because it was probably one of the first times you were around the same type of talent at the same position. And you're completely a fish out of water. You're coming to Southern California back at year 2000 or 2001, when you're coming out to LA for that experience. What was that like for you, and how did it shape you, and what advice would you give to those young quarterbacks?
Well, you can't, I mean, one of the things I really try to focus on is that, I mean, you can't really 100% blame this whole red carpet treatment on the kids. I mean, there's, you know, they didn't make carpet, and they didn't, you know, market the red carpet that's being rolled out. I mean, it's just an opportunity for them to, you know, to play football. And if you didn't have that, if you didn't have the glitz and the glamour, the majority of those kids would still go to Southern California or go to, you know, Portland, Oregon. I don't know. I mean, Alaska to go compete against the best. I think that deep down, I want to believe that, competition in at the highest level, people really want to compete with the best. So if it wasn't in Southern California, and if it wasn't all this media stuff around it, which is awesome, by the way, I mean, I'm glad to say that I was a part of it. I mean, it's turned into this mega show. And I mean, I remember when I went, I mean, I'm glad to have had the opportunity to be a part of it. And heck, I don't even know if I'd be invited or even looked at from what's going on with it now and how evolved it's been. But I want to believe that it's not necessarily, you know, like the red carpet treatment. I think kids really, they understand what's going on. I mean, this is the cards that they're dealt, and they want to compete and enjoy themselves. So I wouldn't necessarily look at it as a negative, or if that's what you're inferring or not, but I think that it's just an awesome thing to just get the best people, quarterbacks, receivers, whatever, and to have a competition. I mean, that's really all you can ask for at the core of what competition stands for, is the competing against the best. And it was an awesome environment to be in. I still have great relationships with those guys that I was at that event with in 2001, and still follow it today, and proud to say that I was a part of a program that's morphed into this mega show now. So it was a great experience for me, and it's only gotten better. And I think that they've done a great job of really trying to showcase, you know, the best of the best.
Yeah, well, what I think is cool about it, and, you know, if listeners aren't aware, you know, this is basically American Idol for the top high school quarterbacks in the country. You know, this organization, Student Sports, searches the entire nation. They bring out the best kids of Southern California or on the campus of Nike, and they compete to be named the quote-unquote Elite 11. And it's definitely grown, as Tyler mentioned, and I've been around it for 8 years. And one of the things that I love about it is this: we call it a competition. So literally, Ty, you come into this amazing camp setting, but it is not, you know, a t-shirt and, you know, a Gatorade. You know, you're coming to compete. And when you're in a competitive cauldron, a lot of times for the first time with other alpha males at your specific position, and, oh, by the way, that position is quarterback, you learn a lot about yourself. And as we kind of transition to you heading into University of Pittsburgh, you went in, and there's another signee, you know, Luke Getsy, who's now coaching in the NFL, but you're instantly thrust into this competitive world of quarterback position. And you love competing. Obviously, it's been your lifeblood. We talked about it earlier already. But what was that like for you as a freshman? Because you come in, you play as a freshman in college at quarterback, and you got the student section chanting your name as a freshman in college to play more of the quarterback position. And I've never asked you this, but I'm curious about what that was like for you internally with expectations, with, you know, pressure that you may have put on yourself, because it seemed like you obviously have a high standard for, you know, your level of ability.
Well, I mean, first of all, that part of it was uncomfortable. I was never comfortable with, you know, the student section thing that you were, you know, referring to, or the magazine things, or the newspaper articles or interviews and all. I like that. That was never something that I was comfortable with, and I struggled with it internally because, you know, I remember having conversations with my dad. Like, I don't want to talk to them. Like, you know, I didn't want to do it. I just felt uncomfortable because it was ingrained in me in such an early age. And again, this isn't, you know, BS, but that it was always about the team. Did we win or did we lose? And I struggled with that for such a long time with what the quarterback position came with. And not that you had to like the attention or like the things that you had to do, but it was bigger than you. Like, it wasn't about that you didn't want to do the interview, but it was about how you handled yourself in that interview, or how you handled yourself after a loss, or how you handled yourself after you didn't win the position and you got, you know, in that case in college, I got redshirted. It was bigger than you. And once I grasped that, I started to understand more about the position of quarterback and all that it came with. And it was really, truly bigger than just you. It was what you represented. Coming in with the expectations, playing for my father, being the first freshman to ever play for him, being on both sides of the ball, playing, like, all those things, like, there was nothing that was ever going to get any more pressure packed than, you know, letting your dad down, right? Or being the first person to play for him that, you know, as a freshman. Like, there was never anything that was going to get bigger or more, you know, stressful or pressure packed than that. So it wasn't the pressure. It was that you didn't want to let the city down, because that's why I made my decision to go there, or that you felt like that if you got beat out or you didn't perform at a certain level, that you were letting people down. And that was, again, something that I had to learn from a young age, that's just part of the gig. You know, you're going to let somebody down. Someone's going to think that you should have done better. And that's the cool part about quarterback that I've been able to transfer into the business realm, that you're never going to make everybody happy. It's never about you. It's always about the scoreboard at the end of the game, and did we win and did we lose? And then taking that feedback and transferring that, good or bad, into the next week. And I think that was really kind of that college experience and that's led me to where I'm at now with business, to really, I guess, lend playing quarterback to my passion for what I have to do in business.
Wow. So I'm really interested in how you said this great sentence. You didn't want to let the city down. What's it like to even think that way? You know, I mean, your job isn't to let the city down or raise the city up. Your job was to read the coverage on third down and check the ball down of a kid in his 20s, early 20s. When you have that thought process?
Well, I mean, I think that was self-inflicted. I mean, that was
no doubt.
I mean, whether it's good or bad, I mean, that's the reason why I decided to go there. I mean, I wanted to bring Pittsburgh football, Pitt football back. I knew that I wasn't going to be on my own, but I wanted to be a part of it. So when you set your expectation level, and again, something that my father taught me at a young age, you know, you have your expectations, and then you have your work ethic, and they need to be equal. So if your expectations are higher than your work ethic, then you got to make one or two decisions. You got to lower your expectations or raise your work ethic, and vice versa. And I think that at that point, I had, and then again, when you're young, you think you can, you know, change the world. And I dug my heels in, and I wanted to really do that. And again, I'm not special. I'm not, there wasn't anything unique about that, but that's what I wanted to do. And there was a lot of things that I struggled with during that time, and a lot of things that I learned about myself. I was probably not a very good leader in the sense that I thought that I could will everybody to see it my way. And you and I had numerous conversations over that, Antoon's Pizza, that it was like, how can they just not see it like this? Like, why will they not just do it this way? Or like, you know, just if they would only do it this way, then we would be okay. And I had to learn the hard way that, and because it wasn't, again, it wasn't about me, it was about we. And that's one of the lessons that I learned. And again, I got a little bit off topic, but that was all self-inflicted. But I was proud of Pittsburgh. I wanted to be part of something bigger than just me. I wanted it, you know, to be on that board where it said, hey, Pitt won the national championship and number three was on that roster. Because when you're 32 years old and you have three kids and you come back and you say, hey, you know what, kid, like, I was on that team, like, you feel a sense of accomplishment. And because I felt that when I played in high school, and I wanted to be part of that from, you know, in college.
So you're in college and you come in with another guy everybody knows, Larry Fitzgerald, is a wideout. He's your roommate, your best friend. And then he leaves early day, and what that was like for you. And because he leaves, and then you become the guy. And I remember that press conference when he announced he was going to forego his final 2 years of eligibility. I remember you standing in the back. But I've never asked you what was going through your mind. Obviously, you're proud and jacked for your best friend. But were the wheels turning in your mind of like, okay, Larry, you're taking off. And I just redshirted, so now here we go. It's my time to lead this team.
Well, I mean, first of all, you had to be happy for him. I mean, we joke about it now when we play golf together. Not everybody knows how much your friendship is worth. And at least at that point, when he went in the NFL number three draft pick, at least I knew, because we said, hey, we were going to go to Pitt together. We were going to, you know, do all these great things together. We were going to leave. We were going to go live our childhood dream and play in the NFL together. And he's leaving me, right? And you have that selfish standpoint, like, bud, we're supposed to do this together. But you want to be happy to him. But we joke about it now. At least I knew that our friendship was worth $60 million. Like, at least we knew that. You know, like at least that first contract, at least I knew, you know, all right, well, at least it's not $30 million. At least $60 million is what our friendship's worth, right? So I joke about that all the time. But you're so happy for a guy like that, and you know you want him to live his childhood dream. But you know, really, I was focused on trying to beat out Luke. I mean, he was a great player. He's from Pittsburgh. He's cut from the same cloth, and I had a job to do. I mean, you know, we both were competing head to head, and you know, who knows what would have happened? Free safety if he'd have beat me out, or they would have made a better decision to play him instead of me. I mean, I don't know what, I mean, hindsight, again, it's always 2020. So you don't really know what best situation would have, what better outcome could have happened. But I mean, I was really focused on getting a chance to compete and to play. And that really the funny part about that season is that Larry and I weren't, the first time we were together, like on the captain's coin toss, is for the Fiesta Bowl. The difference was, is I was in a Pitt uniform and he was the honorary captain. He was in a suit, you know? So I think I had that playing different in my head. Like, you know, we were going to play in the Fiesta Bowl together, but he was going to be in a uniform, but he was in this nice, snazzy, expensive suit. And I was, in a Pitt uniform getting ready to play Utah. So, It was cool. You're nothing but excitement and happiness, and his career has taken off, everybody knows the history of that. But I mean, that was a cool moment. I don't think anybody in America would ever pass up saying, you know, hey, you know, my roommate was, you know, an NFL Hall of Famer. So it was, I'm just blessed to be a, you know, to say that he's one of my best friends, was the best man at my wedding, and he's a Hall of Famer. I mean, that's pretty cool. It's something that my kids are going to, you know, going to be able to talk about. I'll be able to talk to my kids about someday.
A lot of football fans understand the rivalry between Pitt and Notre Dame, us obviously included. You're a guy who's always worn his heart on his sleeve. It happens to be one Saturday afternoon. I'll never forget it, and I'm looking forward to your rendition of this memory. But I'm the sideline reporter, and you go into South Bend, and it's just an eerie day, right? I mean, on the cover of the media guy is our fallen former teammate, Billy Gaines. It's almost as though the football gods knew something special was going to happen in South Bend. You go out and just rip it, throw for a school record, I was 5 or 6 touchdown passes. And after the game, you get interviewed by my now colleague, Lewis Johnson, and a podcast subscriber. And you give a comment post-game that took off. One, can you repeat the comment? And two, what was your memory of that moment? And then I'm going to share mine.
You want to share yours first? Or you want me to go?
No, you please. You are the star. Trust me that day.
I'm not the star. But I just got lucky. Well, I mean, you look back on it now, and you know, you're a little bit embarrassed for the swear word.
And just
happened.
To clear it up. You get asked after the game your thoughts, and you say, "I'm so effing proud of these guys," right?
Yeah, that was the quote. You know, but I think that what goes into it, right? I mean, it was we were struggling to kind of right the ship that season, and you know, the history of Pitt Notre Dame, and you know, all the stuff that the media talks about, and Billy Gaines was there, and there's so much emotion going into that game, just in general, with the Notre Dame game, right? The aura of Notre Dame Stadium, touchdown Jesus. And then on top of that, you know, I grew up Catholic and still am. And my grandma wanted me to go to Notre Dame. And like, you know, I thought that I was going to give her a heart attack when I said, yeah, I'm going to pass up the scholarship to Notre Dame to go to Pitt. And, you know, so you have all of that stuff that was created this perfect storm. And we go in and it was a great game. I mean, great college football television, and you know, there was just so much emotion built up, and it was back and forth, and you know, score. I think there was probably 4 scores before, you know, within 3 minutes of the game, and you know, we drove down, we scored a touchdown, or we drove down, scored a touchdown, and then you know, I don't really know the play-by-play, but we kicked a field goal to win the game. And after the game, or after we kicked that field goal, I mean, it was, you know, bam, camera in my face, and they asked the question and about the touchdowns, and I can remember that I didn't, again, feel comfortable talking about that, but it was always, you know, I'm just so, looking back at that YouTube clip, you can see me almost in slow motion think, you're not going to say that. You're not going to say that. You're not going to say that. And then it was like this just, screw it. I'm just so proud of these guys. And you know, you're like, oh, man. But I don't think you really knew how many people were watching, right? I mean, it wasn't that long ago, but I don't think anybody knows how many people really are watching. And then obviously the media stuff came into play, and it was stupid of me to do, but you know, I joke about it now. I said, hey, it was a correctly structured English sentence. I went to school, I used it as an adjective and all those types of things. But again, it's embarrassing to say, you know, swear word on television, and obviously the people that were involved with it. But one thing that I don't really pull punches. I mean, if I'm happy, you'll know. If I'm mad, you'll know. And at that point I was excited, and everybody knew.
No doubt. I mean, I was doing sideline for the Pitt Radio Network, my first job ever out of college. and you do the interview with Lewis, and then I'm there, and you pull me to the side, and you said, oh, my God, I think I just cursed on air, but I can't remember. And I remember being like, that's kind of cool. I think I was like 22, 23 years old. Like, awesome, man. Hell, F yeah. That's what I'm talking about. And it caught fire, as you just referenced. And the thing that I know you won't say, so I'll embarrass you and say it instead, is that, as I referenced, Lewis Johnson, who was working for NBC at the time, is now my partner on the Pac-12 Network. And he said that while you kind of got scolded by their broadcast team, not him, but the guys up in the booth, you sent everyone on that crew a handwritten letter the very next day apologizing. And that's one of those stories that never gets out, right? You're on the front page, Palco curses, but it is not even on the back page that he apologized in a really genuine fashion. And when he told me that story 2 years ago when we started working together, I just kind of smiled and said, yeah, you know, that's Tyler. That's his parents. That's exactly who, you know, this kid is.
Well, I mean, you know, that's stuff that, I mean, that stuff shouldn't be publicized. I mean, I made a mistake, and, you know, that's how I decided to handle it and write a handwritten letter. I mean, whether it was, you know, I did have great parents, and I had people that were, you know, positive influences in my life that gave me, you know, their input on how I should handle it. And I chose to, but that stuff shouldn't be publicized. I mean, again, right. I know it's TV and you're in TV, but, you know, that's just, it's what you should do. I mean, it's just, if you make a mistake and you want to apologize, then, you know, you apologize. I mean, you know, but I think that whole thing was blown out of proportion. But again, it's TV, it's, you know, entertainment, people need stuff to talk about. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it happened. I apologize for it. It was something that I obviously wouldn't do again. I regretted doing it, but, you know, it was organic, and he asked the question and I answered. So right. I don't think I've ever sworn on TV after that.
I highly doubt you have, but I know you're right. I mean, those are the things that I think, if someone in your shoes is, you don't need to tell that story about me writing a letter. That's embarrassing. I don't need people to know that, but I do think that's a great lesson. You know, we've got a lot of young high performers out there that are a version of Tyler Palko right now, that are up and coming athletes. And I think it's important to know that if you do, you know, make a mistake, whether it's a swear word or anything else, like, own up to it and deal with it versus having somebody else deal with it or send a tweet out about it, about your apology, whatever it is, face the music. And you've always done that. So A, I commend you for that. And B, I think people will pull from it. But this whole podcast is about less traveled. And I think you would agree that growing up in Western Pennsylvania, like you referenced, you had this dream of going to the NFL. You went with your instinct and went against the grain and went to Pitt. Your career did not end up like Dan Marino's. You did not win that national championship ring, but you did learn a lot. What I'm curious about next is, when you enter the next phase of your life, you know, here you are, you're about to go into the National Football League, or at least take a run at it. And you're not necessarily a home run pick for anybody, at least in their perception early on. What did your internal dialogue sound like when you were making the transition to now achieve what you described as a childhood dream?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, you go through a lot of emotions. You go through, to be honest with you, you know, you think about, you go through, I want to quit, or, you know, I'm done with this stuff, or, you know, well, I'm going to show them. And then you feel, you know, grateful that you have an opportunity, and you're like, I'm going to make the most of it. It's a whirlwind of emotions. And I don't think, if anyone's ever being honest with themselves or honest with anybody having a conversation, you go through a whirlwind of emotions. I mean, to play at the highest level, to do anything at the highest level, there's a reason why there's only very few people that have been there and that have stayed there. It takes a lot. I mean, it takes a lot emotionally, physically, spiritually, everything. And, you know, you go through those ups and downs, and I think that it's really that idea of, how do you handle the big wave, right? You're a big surfer. How do you handle the big wave, and how do you handle the low points, right? I mean, how do you handle the ups and the downs? And you learn. I mean, I'm by no means was I a, you know, did I handle every situation perfectly, and did I, you know, am I the model example of what, you know, how you should handle things, but you go through a lot of emotions. And I think that as long as you're aware of them, you know, as long as you're aware of those emotions and you experience those emotions, you experience excitement and sadness and pain and sorrow and being pissed off and, you know, being happy and you're aware of them, I think it's great. I think that it's great that you as long as you're aware, you're self-aware, you have emotional intelligence to know, you know, what they feel like and, you know, to know that, hey, I don't want to feel like this again, or I wish I would have handled it better, and I can't wait to put myself in that situation again. That's the things that I drew from that up and that down. And granted, I wish I would have done things, you know, maybe a little bit differently, and maybe my career would have lasted longer, or maybe my career wouldn't have. But, you know, I learned a lot from that whole process. And I remember it, and I draw from it every day. And those are the things that I'm thankful for, that I was put in those situations, but I was really aware of what they were like, how I felt, you know, what I could have done different, how I would never make those mistakes again, or how I could replicate those things. I mean, it was a great process for me, personally. And again, I draw on it every day, especially with what, you know, what I do for a living.
What was your emotional process like when you went to the Saints? It was the first team. They pick you up, you're free agent, coming out of Pitt. And you go to this franchise that, I don't know if people knew it at the time, but what obviously was trending specifically offensively. You talked about your EQ and understanding your emotions. What was that like day one when you all of a sudden get to their facility?
Well, I mean, first of all, you go at the time, and again, by no means are the projections right, but at that time, I was projected to go second to fourth round, right? So that was first day-ish, maybe second day. So, you know, you had your family over, and you didn't go, and you're like, oh, my God, I didn't go the first day, but, you know, there's always a second day, and, you know, you ride that wave of emotions, and then, you know, you don't get picked, and then, you know, you go through those emotions where, like, man, like, I'm not getting picked, this sucks, like, what the heck, like, what's going on, what's wrong with me, what's wrong with them, you know, I did this, and, you know, we did this, and all those things, and then, you know, you're like, man, I don't want to do this anymore, like, you know, I'm going to go do something else, and then the phone rings, and it's Drew Brees, and, you know, it says, hey, Tyler, you know, and you immediately are like, you know, you're hey, how's things going, and, you know, hey, I know things aren't, you know, working out for you the way that they want. You know, we had that whole conversation, and then Coach Payton called me, and, you know, they gave me an opportunity, and you know, you go down there, and you kind of balance everything back up again, right? And you pull your, you know, again, sorry for the cliche, but you tighten your sneaks up, and you go back at it. And at that point, I was going down there, and I was going to compete. And I wanted to be the starter. And what kind of crazy person thinks they're going to go in and as an undrafted free agent and beat Drew Brees out? But that's why, you know, I got along so well with him, and we competed every day. Granted, he's probably like, who the heck is this kid think he is? But he taught me a lot about competition. He taught me a lot about fighting and competing. And heck, that didn't even work out really well. I mean, I was only there for 2 years. I got cut. It was up and down and all that stuff. But again, I drew a ton from that.
What did he teach you about competition that you still remember?
He always competed. He always competed. He was the only guy that I've ever, from a just a physical standpoint, like he would like I could go at every day, like, you know, all right, let's do 50 push-ups. And then it was like, okay, well, I'm going to do 75. And or whether it was, let's jump rope and see who can go the longest without it stopping. Or, you know, let's see who can throw touchdown, the fade balls into the garbage can. It was such a cool thing for me, because at that point, I didn't think there was anybody else out there like that, because I was always the person that wanted to try to get that from other people. And I was like, man, there's this guy that he was now pushing me, and it was awesome. It was, we probably almost came to blows sometimes in the weight room or playing basketball or. But it was just such a cool experience for me, because for the first time in my life, like I had somebody else that he was the rabbit that the horses were chasing around the track. Right? He was the rabbit that I was chasing, and it was awesome.
So you reference, you get let go, you bounce around to the Cardinals, you bounce from the CFL, and then eventually you end up with the hometown Pittsburgh Steelers for a stint. How big, or what was the chip like on your shoulder when you were going through that? And you talked about a level of commitment earlier in competition. How did that alter and evolve over those couple years?
Well, I mean, I was only at the Steelers for a couple games, and that year was hard for me because I got cut, and I had to get surgery on my thumb, and you know, there's that whole legality thing where you get cut and you got to heal, but you're not on a team, and you got to go through this whole thing, and that was really hard because I finally, you know, I bounced around and I went up and rehabbed and was with the Montreal Alouettes with, you know, Coach Trestman up in Canada, and then, you know, I went to, I don't even remember, I think I went to Arizona, then I went to Montreal, then I went to Pittsburgh, and it was just this whole big, you know, nomad thing. I learned a lot about myself, really, because it was me, right? I was in Arizona by myself, right? I mean, Larry was a superstar. I had to go and take care of these, you know, and try to win a spot. And then that didn't work out. And then I had to go to Canada. And I had to go, you know, then I ended up in Pittsburgh. And, you know, that was only for, you know, a couple games. And it was just this up and this down. But again, it was those things that you draw from that. And I mean, I can't specifically remember everything I drew from it, but I just knew at every moment I was really continuing to work toward that main goal to, hey, I want to become a starter in the NFL. And that was a really instrumental part of my life. Cause I remember sitting in the hotel room in Canada, in Montreal, Canada, like, what am I doing here? Like, I'm in a French speaking country. Like, what am I doing here? Like, they play football with 12 people, not 11. Like, what am I doing here? I don't even know. But it was that, how do you move on? How do you, you know, do those types of things? So, it was a very instrumental year for me.
So then you get your shot, you know, you go to Kansas City, the starter, Matt Castle, gets hurt, and now you're starting in the NFL. And I can remember watching it, just like we started this podcast, you know, I still remember you as a 14, 15 year old. And I can remember watching every snap in that game against, I think with the Patriots was the first game that you started in. What was it like, the buildup? And I think we even talked like the week of that game or a couple of days before, but I'd love to go inside your mind then of, you know, since you were a child, you dreamt to start in the NFL and you've gone through hell and high water in that situation. Obviously we know there's worse things in life, but you go through coaching change in college, you go through injuries in the NFL, being undrafted as you referenced, banged up, let go, re-signed, you know, sitting in a French-speaking restaurant, and now here you are starting against, you know, what is known as one of the greatest teams in the last 15 years, in the Patriots. What was going on in your mind?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm not the only person that ever goes through that up and that down. So, I mean, like this is not a sob story. I mean, everybody goes through that. Everybody has a struggle. So, I mean, but it was – it was this culmination of things, right? That you finally got there. But I remember that the only thing that I was thinking of was like, yes, I finally get my opportunity. You know, Matt got hurt, so you're up. You know, you have to tote that. You know, hey, it's his team still, but you know, I'm here to just be the backup, and you understand that role. But then you're like, it hits you, and you're watching film, and it's like, I'm going to have to go play against Bill Belichick's defense. It's like, holy cow. You know, like, what the heck? I mean, you know, like, what the heck am I going to do, right? So it was just this big overwhelming experience. It was a really cool thing.
And then you play your hometown team, the Steelers. What do you recall about that night and the first conversation you had after the game with your dad?
One more time, Yoke.
Yeah, so then you go and you play the Steelers. And I'd love to know, when you look back at that game now, what do you recall from that night? And then specifically, what do you remember about the conversation with your father after that game?
The Steelers? Well, it was you know, it was one of those things where, you know, he came in town for the game and we had an opportunity to to win, you know, that game. We're driving to win the game, and we lost in the last second. I threw an interception to I can't remember who it was to. I think it was Keenan. And, you know, I would have handled it a lot differently because, you know, now, you know, they were just wanted to be there for you. But I was just so mad. I was like, man, this was my opportunity. We had a chance to win this game, blah, 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 all that stuff. And all he wanted to do was be there for me. And he was upset for me, too. But, you know, my family was there. And he just, you know, that was one of those things. If you go back on it, you would have just been able to say, hey, you know what, crack open a beer and say, hey, you know, things didn't work. I got a chance to play against the Pittsburgh Steelers. No, it didn't work out. But that's life. I mean, that's perspective that you have now, you know, when you're older. And at the time, you know, the only thing that mattered, going back to competition, was winning. And we didn't win. And I was mad. I was pissed as hell, you know. But, you know, but you can look back on it now and say, man, you know, sorry for being that way, but you know, that's what family's for. They were there, they loved me, and they had an opportunity to, you know, to be there for me.
So last couple on your football career, because I want to transition into how you've taken all these principles and lessons into what you're doing now. But I'd like to know that if you look back and just say the first answer that comes to mind, but what was the highest point in your football career?
The highest moment?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, getting a chance to start my first NFL game was probably the highest moment. Most impactful moment was the moment that I got that Coach Harris benched me for two series against Nebraska. That was the most impactful moment in my football career because it allowed me to say, Tyler, stop trying to do everything. Stop trying to do everything and just play football. So that was the biggest, most impactful moment for me.
What was the lowest moment?
When football, after that season, I was playing, you know, with the Chiefs, and I had my opportunity to play in the NFL for the first time. And, you know, you thought that, man, you know, I had a pretty good showing. You know, obviously things didn't work out the way we wanted to, but, you know, that, you know, somebody must have saw some good in what we did. And, you know, just excited for the next opportunity. And no one wanted me. No one signed me. And to realize that it could be over that quick was – first of all, it was almost insightful. I was kind of pissed at my dad because he was right. It ended, and I had no say-so on when it was going to end. And it was over. I mean, it was like it was over in a heartbeat. So that was the lowest moment in my football career because it was over. I mean, I wasn't going to go throw passes in the summertime to work out and run, you know, 110s anymore to be with the fellas and to get, you know, in shape and go through training camp and try to earn a spot. It ended. That was scary for me. You know, you were like, my God, it's over. So that's probably the lowest.
When did that become real for you? Is it the following training camp? Is it the training camp after that? You know, when was it, wow, Dad, you're really right. Like, now I'm going to get a job.
Well, I mean, it was because, well, I mean, you can't just call people up and say, hey, you know, Mr. Colbert, can you guys re-sign me? Can I get an internship and get a tryout as a, you know, with the Steelers? It was such a weird experience because it just ended, you know, like, and it wasn't like, oh, well, I got to go get a job right now. Right. But it was just like, what do I do? You know what I mean? I was educated. I knew that I had options. I knew I had opportunities to play or to get jobs, but it was like, where do I start? You know, like, do I coach? Do I want to coach? And I think you and I have had those conversations. You know, do I want to coach? Do I want to get into this? But I'm good at it, but I don't want to do it because football, like, you know, it's, I can't be too close to it because I can't play it. I mean, you go through this, just ups and downs, these emotions, and maybe I don't think I'm unique in that, but I think everybody goes through that, but you don't know what to do, you know, like you can, you know, wrap yourself in it, you know, and I could have went and been a GA and just continued to go down that road, but I didn't know what I wanted to do at that time. But it was crazy. It really was. It was probably the only time in my life where I was like, oh, what do I do? You know, like you always knew as an athlete, like, well, all right, well, next play, right? Or, you know, next rep, or, you know, next game. But now you're like, oh, what now? And it was weird.
Did you watch Kobe drop 60 in his last game?
I did. I'm not a huge Lakers fan, but you're a fan of competitors, and whether you like them or hate them or whatever it is, that, I mean, he embodied competition. I mean, take whether you like him or dislike him as a person, as a personality, you know, in sports. It was almost fitting, right, that he dropped 60 in his last game, right?
Well, I asked that because this is the only time I think I'll ever say I related to Kobe, and I'm curious if you did as well. And he does his post-game interview on the floor with Lisa Salters, I believe, on ESPN. And, you know, he drops 60 as a reference. And she goes, so are you coming back? And he kind of chuckles and he goes, no way. Like, I gave the game everything I had. And, you know, I went through that road of coaching. And obviously playing, and wasn't nearly as talented as you, but had to give everything, you know, literally for sacrificing every relationship you had to, you know, I know I slept with the football from 14 to 22. Do you feel that way? Did you feel that way when you knew it was over in terms of, I gave this game my life, or did you feel like a sense of regret at times?
I never regretted anything. Never regretted anything in regards to football. I mean, I think I don't regret, you know, I don't wish I would have worked harder or done, you know, given the game anymore, because I don't think that I physically or mentally could have given the game anymore. But when it ended, I still felt like I could play. I still felt like I could do all those things. So there wasn't a sense of necessarily regret, or felt like I wish I would have handled things differently. It was just a weird moment where I was still working out. Like, I still was throwing, I was still doing those types of things, and I don't even know why. No one was calling, but I still could do it. There are things that, you know, are outside of your control. I mean, maybe I was crazy and thought that I could play, and, you know, people are like, this kid just can't play. I mean, and, you know, I don't know what came of it, but it was just one of those things where I didn't know what to do. To answer your question, I knew that I couldn't give it anymore, but at the time I felt like I could still do it. Like, I felt like I could still play and compete. But you go through the thing, well, why isn't it happening? Well, you know, you can spend your life sitting there waiting for something to happen, or, you know, move on with your life's work. I mean, you can't just, you know, stand outside and say, hey, you know, sign me up. Someone's got to want you. But it was all a cool experience, because it was, you know, I'd never experienced those types of emotions before.
You know, and I can say this, I think, with a lot of confidence, that whether it's me seeing you in person or talking to your teammates in the past, I don't know anybody who's given more to the craft. And I think that I'm sure deep down that you don't want to say that, but you know that. And that's what I admire the most. My last question that I want to hit you on before we go into how you've taken all this to the next level of your life is, when you look back, Tyler, because I think that you were too hard on yourself. Do you think you were too hard on yourself?
In what respect? When you mean I was too hard on myself?
I think that you held yourself to such a high standard, which we all should do as high performers. But I think that sometimes you maybe didn't have as much fun as you possibly could have. Is that incorrect when you look back on your career?
No, I think you're right on. I mean, I want to make sure that I'm careful in answering this question because, you know, I think that people can, you know, sit there and say, well, you were too hard on myself. And like if I did this and I should have done this, and I don't want it to be like that, but I definitely didn't have enough. I didn't enjoy the moment, and really savor, you know, I didn't appreciate the wins and the loss, the wins that I had and, you know, the things that I overcame or really, you know, dove into, you know, man, like you just had an opportunity to go to college for free, or you just started in the Fiesta Bowl, or, you know, and I don't know if anybody really truly does that. I don't know of anybody that really smells the roses at the moment that they're in, or at least I've never talked to anybody. But yeah, I mean, hindsight, I wish I would have enjoyed college more and, you know, traveled the world like you did. And, you know, I mean, I'm jealous of those things. I mean, I follow you all the time and see the pictures and the life in a walk. And, you know, you look back and you're like, man, he just really, like, he gets it. Like, did I miss my opportunity to do those types of things? And, you know, why was I so hard on myself? And why didn't I just enjoy the things that, you know, that I accomplished? And sure, I mean, I think that, but I my personal opinion, that's all part of, you know, who I am today. And, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I sure don't make the same mistakes twice. And, you know, I'm lucky to have guys like you in my life to keep things in perspective on really what's important.
What would you tell the Tyler Palko at 18, 19, 20 years old right now, if you could?
What would I tell myself at 18 or 19 years old? Man. That's a great question. I would tell him, keep your foot on the gas pedal. Do it like, you know, you feel like you wanted to do it. And I probably would have changed a couple of things, you know, again, being able to be introspective, but just to keep my foot on the gas pedal, because I don't think I was very talented. I don't think I was, you know, the smartest guy. I do think that one of the things that I did bring to the table is that I, you know, was able to keep my foot down, and I really kind of hung my hat on that. So I would just tell myself, at 18 or 19, keep your foot on the gas pedal.
I love it. All right, so your gas pedal is now transformed into this really cool company called Solutions 21. And from what I can perceive, because I read your articles, and there'll be a bunch of them on this blog post when this podcast comes out, but it seems like you've become an encourager, right? You've always been that team captain. It seems like you're still doing that now. I don't know specifically what you're doing. I want to learn about it, but it seems like it is like wheelhouse for you, because Walt Harris, probably anyone in your world, pegged you as the next head coach of Pitt, right? And I'm sure there's elements of you that did that. But again, you took a road less traveled and are doing something different, but still leading. So what are you doing, and are you comfortable doing that? Do you think about coaching at all?
Not really. I mean, I never want to shut the door on anything. Obviously, I, you know, feel like I would be do a heck of a job in that position, or a heck of a job being, you know, the athletic director at Pitt, because it's, I don't think there's anybody more for Pitt and than me. But I've fallen in love with this industry that I'm in right now, and it's not motivational. I don't necessarily believe that you know, that motivational speaking is long-term, right? We've all played for coaches or, you know, went to hear motivational speakers that give us perspective. And I still, you know, I watch that Life in a Walk thing, and it still brings me to tears. because I'm close to my father too. And I think those things are important. I really have this passion for closing the gap on developing the next generation of leadership. And what I mean by that is not the academia version of leadership or not the political version of leadership, but really I believe that leaders are made and they're not born. Now, I'm not saying that you know, people don't have, they're not born with certain qualities because of their parents, that they're more, on track to develop these leadership competencies. But I didn't pop out of my mom's belly, with this fast, leadership tool belt, right? It was taught to me, and it was taught to me by a lot of people. And I just think that in business today, sports included, that we tend to focus on, things that are really are linear, right? That are, did you win or did you lose, right? And that's the only thing we're measuring. And we almost, I feel like we're turning into robots, right? We're turning people into just being really good doing X. And we do need that. But someone's got to lead those people at some point, right? I mean, you've had, let's just say J.D. Brookhart. I mean, he was a guy that was probably very instrumental in your life. I mean, shoot, Coach Carroll. You have a very close relationship with him. I mean, those guys are very instrumental in your life. And they've helped develop your leadership competencies. And I really believe that that's going to help businesses, because we're so focused right now on linear things, education. I want somebody who can make 100 widgets in a day and do it, under budget and, fast and cool. And that's important, but someone's got to lead those teams. And I think that we've really dropped the ball on that. And I for whatever reason, I have a passion for it. And that's what we do at Solutions 21. We're charged with really developing the evolution of 21st century leadership. And it's fun as hell.
I, for some reason, believe that 100% you have those natural traits. So, all right, so the last thing, we're going to leave you here. I do this little thing at the end where I'm going to give you a word, and I want your quick, instant answer. Okay, the first thing you think about, all right? All right, here we go.
Yep.
Because I'm super curious about this one, brother. Parenting.
Best thing in the world.
Now, you have three kids, right? You have two twins.
Daughter who's four, Aubrey, and twin boys, Caden and Kaysen, that are just turned one.
Oh, my God. Have they started watching film yet?
Not yet, man. Not yet.
All right, here we go. Next couple words. We'll rip through these. NFL.
Best education I've ever had.
Would you go back? Take another class?
Would I go back? In a heartbeat. In a heartbeat.
I love it.
That we always talk about graduate work. That's master's, doctorate, and anything above that.
What makes you, Tyler, feel most alive?
Personally, family, wife and kids, and I got to get up and people are dependent on me to provide for them. Professionally, changing the mindset on how people view leadership. It's my sole purpose on what I want to do and with the rest of my life.
Pressure.
Goosebumps. I love it. It's what keeps my heart beating.
Joy.
Trisha, Caden, Kaysen, and Aubrey.
Three kids. If I didn't ask the next word. Politics.
Politics. Broken.
Yeah. And to give a little context, Tyler and I, the only time I think we've disagreed in life multiple times is in politics. So we won't dive into that. That's another conversation. Last couple.
Hey, but Yogi, if we can figure out to get some schlep to give us a television show on cable news, it might be the highest rated television show in history. It might beat out the Kardashians or something.
All right, I'm on it. I'm going to start pitching that 100%. Here we go, baby. Here we go. I'd love to know what you think about the word limits.
The what?
The word limits.
No such thing.
And why is that?
I think that, you know, if you were to, I'm not want to put a, you know, an umbrella answer, a blanket answer on this, but, you know, there's no such thing as limits. I don't think that, you know, I think that you're the only one that can stop you. I mean, there's a million ways in the world to get things done, and I don't think there's any such thing as limitations.
Tyler, what does a full life look like to you?
A full life to me would look like knowing that when people came to my funeral that they not necessarily had to like me, but they were impacted in some kind of a positive way by interacting with me. So you know how I am. I mean, I want to make an impact. I want to make a difference. I want to know that my time wasn't wasted on this earth. So that would be a full life to me.
I've always felt that people, every individual on the planet has a flame, perceptually, if you look at them. And their flame is either charging and it's blazing and we're drawn into it like a campfire. Or sometimes their flame is low and you got to put a new log on the fire and kick it over. How would you describe the Tyler Palko flame right now?
Blazing as hot as you can get. I don't think I don't know any other way. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I don't really know any other way but full speed. So I'm sure at some point my age and my football injuries will slow me down, but I don't know any other way than gas pedal full throttle.
And finally, of course, West Virginia.
sad because we don't play them anymore. We don't play them anymore. You know, you're in college football broadcasting right now. I think that, you know, obviously it's a business and all those types of things. We don't play a school that's 70 miles down the street that's a rival. I mean, I think that's sad. I do, now that I'm not playing football, want to say that they have some fantastic golf courses, though.
All right. Well, so let's end on this. When you become the athletic director of Pitt, you'll hire me to be the head coach, and we'll go smoke West Virginia. And after we beat him, we'll play a round of golf with Larry on him.
On him, yeah. You know damn well that he'll find some way to leave you or I with the bill. But I'm totally on that. Totally on that.
I love it, man. Well, look, you've influenced my life in many ways. I think people are going to absolutely love your candor on this. And you've had quite a journey, man. I mean, you really have. And, you know, I think that the lessons that you shared on this short conversation are going to be going to influence a lot of people from young to old and everybody in between, man. So I really appreciate the time. And thanks a lot, man. It's good to reconnect. And we'll make sure we do it again, but not necessarily as a podcast.
No worries, but yo, guy, definitely want to make sure that people know listening to this that life in a walk and the flame that burns inside of you. I don't think we're ever going to see another Yogi Roth, and I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing because the world can't be you're one of a kind. But that Life in a Walk movie that you made with your father has impacted my life, knowing you and knowing your pops and your mom, and your journey is something that that I reference quite often in my day-to-day job. So thank you for letting me talk to you today, but also thanks for being a friend and somebody that it's influenced my life for the better.
Always, man. Love you, brother. Thanks for coming on. We'll definitely
love
talk
you,
soon. All right. Later.
Thanks. See you, buddy.
Yep. So there it is. Tyler Palko, man. How awesome is that? Yeah. Personally, for me to reconnect with him, it's kind of like that friend that you have. That you're like, okay, we haven't talked in a couple of years, but really when we reconnect, it's like we just picked up where we left off, and that's with him. But I love the journey that he went on. I mean, let's just put it in perspective as we put a bow on this episode. He was the dude growing up. I mean, he was the biggest name in high school sports, in high school football at the quarterback position in Pennsylvania, which was a huge, huge deal at the time. And he spurs everybody to go to the University of Pittsburgh, where not a lot of people probably thought he would go. And that was massive. You know, that was like, I don't know, imagine LeBron or Kobe picking a college, you know, maybe not that big, but it was big. You know, he was that big of a personality profile in Pennsylvania. Goes there, things don't go great. And he fights, he competes, and he competes against himself at times. And sometimes that wasn't great. And he talked about that, you know, being hard on himself, not having as much fun. And by fun, it's not going out and partying with the fellas, but it was enjoying the moment versus moving on to the next one. You know, he said that his foot is always on the gas. And that's how I know Tyler for sure. I think now, as he transferred from the NFL to a family and his new job, he's obviously been able to learn from those experiences. And for somebody who got to see it from when he was 14 and 15 all the way through his career, as we stayed in touch and would connect once or twice every year, and whether it was Arizona when he was living there or Los Angeles, it was really cool to see his commitment to a craft. And regardless of what anyone said, no matter how good or bad or talented or gifted or not talented he was, he just kept competing. And I think that on his journey, I think he was able to redefine what it meant to compete. I'm sure early on, as you referenced, it was about how come everybody isn't fighting and competing and working like I am, not in an arrogant way, but in a humble way. And I think that he learned that the process for people to compete is different. And clearly, as he is a leader now and teaching the next generation how to lead, he's recognizing and teaching a variety of different tactics. So, as always, I think that we want to leave us and leave everybody with a challenge. And the challenge I think that Tyler has left us was a statement he said, and it was kind of the theme for him, was, I just want to make a difference. When he was in high school, he felt that way in his community. The reason he chose to go to Pitt was to make a difference. The reason that he competed at the highest of levels in football was to make a difference. And to me, I think that's the challenge. You know, he said it best, and we've said it many times on this show, that the only limits we have in life are the ones we set ourselves. And Tyler hasn't had any. He's fought through them. People try to label him in a profession where you're constantly getting labeled as too strong, not strong enough, too fast enough, not good of an arm, too strong of an arm. And he didn't flinch through all that adversity. So for all of you out there that are competing, battling, fighting, scratching, clawing, seeking, I think this episode leaves us with a simple message from Tyler Palko, is that we want to make a difference in life. And it doesn't mean you got to love us, doesn't mean you have to hate us, but we do want to have our difference felt. So the challenge is, what difference are you making? And is it conscious? And are you doing it daily? Are you doing it moment by moment? And are you doing it without any limits? Thanks a lot. We appreciate your time. As always, feel free to leave us a review. Check it out on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, share it with your friends. Peace.